It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Nice article in the Managing Madrid blog. Wonderful lads that do a great job there. And worth reading about that man there. Karim Benzema needs to rest. The numbers reveal why.
Times ended up almost looking like a 6-3-1. Some very good writing about that on the Managing Madrid website. Great podcast as well. Of course, Pere Valverde was a huge part of the equation.
Hello and welcome to a Monday edition of the Managing Madrid podcast. We are live on YouTube. We are now one day away, just a little over 24 hours away from Real Madrid playing at the Allianz Arena against Bayern Munich in what is one of the most storied, one of the greatest rivalries in Champions League history. Two teams that have a tremendous amount of respect for each other. Two teams that have gone through grueling matches one after the other for almost 100 years now. And it's always grueling. It's almost always tight. And one set of fans is completely heartbroken by the end of it. And the other one gets through not unscathed, but with a lot of wounds. And I don't know if tomorrow and then the second leg is going to be any different. So to help us preview tomorrow's game, special guest Ryan Ali Khan of Bavarian Football Works, of course, our sister website on the SB Nation Network. We are here to get the Bayern Munich perspective and also just talk about tomorrow's game. Ryan, welcome to the show, man. How you doing?
Thank you for having me. I'm feeling great about this, yeah.
You're feeling great about tomorrow as well? Like, how do you actually feel as a Bayern fan? Raw emotion.
No. I dread Real Madrid more than any other team, really. So this is a nightmare for me. I would rather face Manchester City again rather than face Madrid.
Wow. So you're not one of those fans that there was a video that went viral where the Bayern fans were celebrating when Rudiger scored at the Etihad his penalty. You wanted City.
Well, I think we can approach it two ways, but just to say that, yeah, it's an opponent that would theoretically be easier for Bayern to deal with. I don't think it is. But in theory, Real are not as comprehensive and intense as Manchester City are in a game like this. But I think it's more about the fact that Bayern fans as a whole try to uphold heritage of football, and the sort of institution that is Manchester City kind of goes against those values. So I think more than anything, we're kind of just happy to see those kinds of institutions fail.
Yeah, that was the explanation. I saw one of the explanations that, responded. There was a Bayern fan who responded to this video because there was this notion or narrative that Bayern fans were celebrating because they wanted to face Real Madrid because they were quote-unquote easier. But his explanation was like, no, we're not celebrating for that reason. We're celebrating because Real Madrid versus Bayern is just more special. That's it. It's a bigger, has a bigger historical significance. It is a bigger rivalry. And, it's called the European Clásico for a reason. At least that's the name it's been taken on, that it's been given, because it truly is something really special, and it somehow hasn't happened in, what, 6 years, I think? 2018 was the last time. 7 years, whatever.
Yeah, six, actually.
2018. Yeah. So 6 years. So it's been a while. I mean, Ancelotti said something interesting in the pregame press conference today, which concluded, I don't know, like an hour or two ago. He said that these two teams are good at not having a particular football identity, and that they can play in various ways, whether it's low block, mid block, aggressive press, whatever. And I kind of looked at that quote and I was like, you know what? In my opinion, this is why these are also two of the most successful teams in the competition's history, is because they're able to shapeshift. They're able to have a plan B, a plan C. They're able to adapt to various game states within the same game. They can shapeshift based on their opponent and what the moment needs at the time, right? And I thought that was a really great quote, and it's a good summary, I think, of why this success is there. I have so much to ask you about Ryan. Like, I don't know entirely where to start. I guess I'm going to start in reverse chronological order because I'm having trouble keeping up with who's injured and who's not injured, who trained today, who didn't train. Can you give us like the definitive update of what's going on with everybody?
We are all also struggling to keep up because especially this season, we seem to just have a multitude of injuries. Until today, it seemed like Leroy Sané wasn't fit to play until Tuchel came out and famously said that Serge Gnabry will score. It seemed like he wouldn't play either, but both of them were back in training. Konrad Leimer was also back in training, but Matthijs de Ligt was missing, which is a big loss for me. He's probably my favorite player to watch. Sacha Boey will be missing, and Bruno Sar will also be missing, as well as Kingsley Coman as well, whose season ended a couple of weeks ago with a knee injury, or an ankle injury, actually, I believe it was. So that's pretty much the injury list. Everyone else seems to be somewhat available. I don't think Sané will get a full 90, even if he plays, but everyone else seems ready to go, hopefully.
So as an observer of Bayern Munich, who obviously follows the team infinitely closer than I do, are Bayern as bad as the league table would suggest?
I would say they're worse than the league table suggests.
Wow, okay.
What's happened under Tuchel, in my opinion, is that he's sort of tried to change the footballing philosophy of the club, which, I mean, as a club, they are more malleable, but as players, you kind of struggle to adapt to that. And the sort of players that we've brought in over the last few years, you know, under Hansi Flick, under Julian Nagelsmann, under Ancelotti and Pep before them, they sort of fit the mold of players who like to play a possession style of football, who try to, you know, have fluid movements, keep the ball, try and patiently build up and break through a block. But Thomas Tuchel's ideas about football are very different to that. Of course, he relies on a more counterattack and low block based or mid block based football that doesn't have as much space for long spells of possession in it. So the players have struggled to adapt to that. And we can see that in the kind of transfer targets that we've also had and the players that we've brought in since Thomas Tuchel has joined the club. Obviously, players like Eric Dier and Sacha Boey, these are players who are more comfortable being away from the ball for large periods of time compared to players like Matthijs de Ligt, Joshua Kimmich, Thomas Müller, Jamal Musiala, these players who enjoy having the ball for, you know, 55 to 60% of the game. So that sort of that fracture between the players' familiarity or tactical familiarities and the coach's tactical style has created this sort of gap in what the players want to do and what the coach wants to do. So that sort of resulted in poor performances all around. And we've overperformed, actually, because we have the individual brilliance of players like Harry Kane, Jamal Musiala, at the back, you know, Kim Min-jae. In midfield, Alexander Pavlovich and Leon Goretzka have been putting in very good performances. Leroy Sané in the first half of the season, for me, was, alongside Jude Bellingham, the best player in the world. But those performances can only take you so far.
So that aside, all those things you said, and that kind of surprised me a little bit, in part because I was looking at like the defense, and the defense on the surface looks terrible. I mean, the amount of goals you guys conceded, I think you've conceded more than Stuttgart, Leipzig, Dortmund. The expected goals against number is a little bit better and actually is one of the better figures around in the big five leagues. And I thought maybe for that reason, you guys have had some bad luck too. Obviously, Neuer's injury didn't help. All that said, with all those troubles you have domestically, what you said about individual brilliance, plus what we've seen against Arsenal over two legs, do you think your ceiling is higher in like a two-legged cup game than what you've shown this season in the league?
Yes, for sure. We have a higher ceiling. We have more gears that we can shift into, but it remains to be seen where our ceiling truly is, especially under Tuchel, who just sort of doesn't have tactics that gel with the players very much. I feel like that definitely puts a hard cap on how far these players can go in the performances. But honestly, if we want to talk about the ceiling of a team, there's no team in the world that has a higher ceiling than Real Madrid. I will say that openly. This team has an insane level of individual talent. And it shows on the pitch when Ancelotti doesn't employ, you know, very complex tactics or very, you know, an intense style of play. But the fact that he just knows where to put these players and how to manage each player individually, it shows, because those performances are something else. Real Madrid didn't get to the semifinals by luck. As much as fans of the teams that came against Madrid might want to say that, it's not luck. There's a reason they got here. And it's because of those players. So I feel like if we want to talk about ceilings, Bayern are out of their depth.
You're one of the rare opposing fans who seem to think that, which is nice. It's a refreshing take to hear you say that. But I think, and to your point, so Carlo Ancelotti said something else interesting today where he said there are two types of managers, those that do nothing and those that do damage. And I like to be of those that do nothing. And what he meant by that is basically like you don't need to overmanage. You basically just need to allow freedom and get everyone at their best level. And that's always been his coaching style. Having said that, it will be interesting how he approaches this from a tactical level. And him and, I mean, Tuchel was kind of saying similar things in that, like, you know, it more important than the tactics tomorrow is kind of how we manage the game and how we, you know, how we hold on to the ball and how we limit chances conceded. Do you guys see it? Do you see it similarly to the way you approach Arsenal? Kind of just being compact, conservative, narrow on defense, that kind of idea?
I mean, I feel like in a general stylistic sense, yes. But we have to realize that Real Madrid are a very different team to Arsenal. Arsenal, of course, like to attack through the wings a lot more than Real Madrid. Real Madrid rely on, of course, Jude Bellingham with the second striker runs. They have a lot more movement. And I think Arsenal are just in general better in the middle. Real Madrid are better in the middle than Arsenal. And that's something we have to account for, because a lot of the reason that we got through the first leg especially and parts of the second leg was because our midfielders just had the legs on Arsenal's double pivot, and Martin Odegaard was basically taken out of the game. The only time Arsenal really got a foothold in the center was when Alexander Zinchenko was playing, because he would invert into the center. But against Real Madrid, when you have, you know, a quartet of players like Jude Bellingham, Luka Modric, Toni Kroos, and Federico Valverde, that's not going to happen. We can't rely on Gretzka and Laimer to run 13 kilometers again, because even if they do, that's still going to leave at least one man, if not two, free.
Well, it's one of those things for us that, like, as much as I personally think it was a mistake for you guys to sack Nagelsmann for whatever weird reasons you guys did and then bring in Tuchel, and obviously everything that has happened since then reflects that, you know, I don't think Tuchel is taking this team into a very positive direction. Having said that, like, we have faced Tuchel three times with three different teams, and it's never easy. The guy just seems to have, Even if we do ultimately slay him and we do advance, there are definitely, like, he's the type of coach that can look at 30 minutes, 45 minute blocks, or even one leg blocks and be like, okay, that's what we did wrong. Here's the adjustment, and this is what we're going to throw out. And then the adjustment is always a great response. So he has that. That's why I said, like, you guys in a two-legged tie, your ceiling is definitely higher. What worries you about Real Madrid the most, like, when you see that team?
It's the aura of it. It's a word that gets thrown around a lot, but I feel like it applies to this team if it applies to any team in the world, because they never seem to be this, you know, all-conquering, unbeatable gods. But then you come up against them in a game and they just don't make a mistake. Nothing ever goes wrong. And even when they're behind, you come into the last 10, 5 minutes of a game, you enter extra time, and then they shift up another gear while everyone else is tired. They're still, you know, accelerating. And that's the sort of thing that terrifies me, because not only do they have the mentality to push until the end, even if they're even slightly ahead or they're drawing, but they have the individual technical brilliance to pull off whatever half chances they get. I mean, you look at their miracle run in 2022. It's ridiculous to conceive of a Champions League run of that sort of proportion. Like, if somebody wrote that kind of thing in a script for a film, that everyone would say this is really unrealistic. But it actually happened. That's the kind of, you know, magic that Real Madrid can produce. And these are the kinds of moments that create players, and these players have already been created. These are players that can go on and recreate those moments now. I don't know if Bayern can handle that, because Bayern have already been a little weak, especially, you know, during the late minutes of a game, especially when they're chasing a game. They have shown a tendency to give away chances. And those are the kinds of chances that Real Madrid will take, and they have taken in the past. You know, you look at the previous meetings that Bayern Munich and Real Madrid have had. Bayern have, on a chance-based and on a possession-based metric, dominated the game. But Real Madrid always came out on top. You have to go 12 years back to find the last time that Bayern Munich beat Real Madrid.
Was that, it must have been the 07, 08?
11, 12.
It was when we had Capello. I think it was 06, 07. There, or was it
wasn't
one
there
after
the season
that?
Where, wasn't it, it was, oh, I think sorry, it was the oh season God, where I, we went into yeah. the Champions League final.
The penalty shootout, yeah. I actually unconsciously erased that from my memory, and therefore I completely skipped that. How long have you been a Bayern Munich fan for?
2014 is when I started watching. I think I was like 9 years old then.
Okay. Well, you just in time for for that the Pep Carlo 5-0 bloodbath. Well, look, I think the thing, I mean, what you said about the aura, I mean, it's kind of a funny thing, and this has been, the word aura has been thrown around a lot in the last year or so. It's been gaining traction, this word. Taking chances. And it's, you know, reflecting back on our summer, last summer, when we lost Benzema, we didn't sign any striker to replace him, apart from Kozulu, who obviously is not at that level. Jude Bellingham has taken on this role of this pseudo nine who, you know, links up, does a lot of defensive work. Far from a traditional nine, deep drops deep a lot. If you would have told me that we had that in our chamber to kind of just take chances at a lethal rate, I would have been a little bit surprised. But the reality is that we have been able to do this. If you look back on the Leipzig and City 4 games total, excuse me, I don't have much of a voice today. A lot of the narrative was, these guys got dominated. They didn't deserve to win. You know, with that narrative in particular against City, I don't, you know, we scored 4 goals against them total. And it was not on a high volume amount of chances. First leg, a little bit more. Second leg, definitely not. So we're taking these minimal chances that we have, and we are putting them in the back of the net. Leipzig was the same. Leipzig, we didn't do much in that second leg. Or first leg. In the first leg, Brahim scores from distance. In the second leg, we had this incredible Jude and Vinny counterattack that we just capitalized on. So we haven't needed a high volume of chances to put our chances away, which has been nice, because we weren't sure if we were able to sustain, you know, overperforming our XG in the post-Cristiano era and in the post-Benzema era, and we have, which is nice. So I think your concern is valid in that sense. But I did want to ask you about this, because I haven't watched Bayern as much as I would like. I've been tuning in since we drew you guys. I rewatched Arsenal second leg. I saw that game against Frankfurt on the weekend. Can you talk to me about Davies? Obviously, Mazraoui is starting at left back right now.
Yeah.
And this is a guy we've been linked with. We're keeping our eye on him. I'll let you take over before my voice gives up.
Yeah, so the thing with Davies is I feel like he sort of checked out mentally. He just doesn't seem to be putting in the kinds of performances that we expect of him, especially if we were to give in to his demands. He's asking for reportedly, you know, somewhere in the region of 20 million euros per year or just under that. That's not the kind of fee that we can afford for a player who is very mercurial with his performances. And honestly, since the sextuple season under Hansi Flick, he hasn't really developed. He still looks like the same 19-year-old fresh face that had still come, that had just come onto the scene and had rough edges to his game. He still has very rough edges. He sort of gets away with it because of his physical gifts. He's very strong and he's lightning quick. And those kinds of qualities tend to make you more, make it easier to forgive you when you're in bad positions defensively. Because if you're out of position and somebody runs in behind, you have the pace to catch up to them. if you're in a 50-50, you tend to win those duels purely because the other person might take a heavy touch or they might try and get around you and they simply cannot. But Davies, technically as a player, has not grown, and definitely mentally as a player hasn't grown. I would say that a 19-year-old Davies back in 2020 still makes the same decisions as the 23-year-old Alphonso Davies that we see today. There seems to be very little that has changed, only really just his tactical role. Him as a player, I just feel like he hasn't developed. But he is 23. Let's preface this with that. It's not like he's in his prime years or anything. So I would still not like to lose him. But if we are to lose him, I don't mind losing him now. And I don't mind losing him for the fee that Bayern are demanding of him, even if it is a little low for a potentially world-class wing back.
Yeah, the problem is, if it is a problem, I don't know if Real Madrid will actually pay that fee this summer or just wait it out. Because Ferlan Mendy's contract expires in 2025, which falls in line with Davies' contract as well. I don't know. We'll see. But how much do you think we'll actually see Davies against Real Madrid in these two legs? Off the bench?
I don't think he'll start for sure. I just don't see him starting. But maybe off the bench late in the game. I don't really see Tuchel utilizing him much because he has very definite defects in his defensive technique and especially his tackling, which has been wobbly for years and years now. But if he is used, maybe he could be used as a left winger. Tuchel seems to prefer left-footers as his left wingers right now. Rafael Guerrero is most likely to start in that position in the first leg. Maybe we could see him there. I don't see him being used for more than 45 minutes, unless we go into extra time, of course. But in the first 180, I don't see him playing more than 45, barring injuries.
So let me know if I get this right. Because, as you know, I've been trying to keep up with all your absentees. And so we know we're not sure about Sané. Musiala looks like he's good to go. And we're sure that Coleman is not going to play. Gnabry, as you said earlier, prophesized by Tuchel that he'll score, which is one of the headline quotes from today's press conference. Brave. So, is it safe to say Kimmich right back, Mazraoui left back, Dier and Kim in the middle?
I would say so, yeah.
Lamer, who had an incredible assist on the weekend.
Yeah.
We're not sure about him yet, right? Or do you think he'll make it?
He was in training, but I'm not sure if he'll play, especially because he plays a very intense game. I'm not sure if he's ready for that. Personally, I would play Pavlovic, but it really depends on what Tuchel is demanding of his midfielders and what kind of role he wants them to play, because they are very different midfielders, Laimer and Pavlovic.
So either Laimer or Pavlovic in a double pivot with Goretzka, right?
Yeah.
Kane up top, obviously. Musiala, and then that leaves two spots. Sané, maybe one of them. Does Guerrero play a little bit higher as a left winger?
Guerrero in the last few weeks has been playing as a left winger. In fact, that combination has worked really well of Guerrero and Mazraoui. It almost seems like an inversion of what managers generally do, which is have a left footer at left back and a right footer at left wing. They sort of inverted that. So Mazraoui kind of takes spaces that are a little more aggressive in the half spaces, and Guerrero tends to hang wider. So that sort of combination has worked really well, actually. I feel like that's what Tuchel is going to go for again. And it's what everyone's predicting as well.
So before we started recording, you mentioned that you had a few questions for me as well. So why don't you fire away, and I'm curious to know what's on your mind.
Yeah. So when I was
We lost your audio, buddy. You may have disconnected your mic. No. You're muted now.
Am I on now?
You're back, yeah.
All right. Yeah, so while I was previewing this game, I did a tactical preview, an article which will come out in about half an hour. When I was looking at the 11s, I sort of sat down and put down the 11, the back four, as Lucas Vazquez, because of course Carvajal is suspended, Eder Militao, Aurelien Tchouameni, and Eduardo Camavinga. But what I'm seeing now from reports is that Nacho Fernandez is going to play alongside Ferland Mendy. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so this is the combination we had at the Etihad too, which worked from a defensive standpoint, which is something we were worried about. Not about Mendy, because Mendy has pretty much been very reliable in all these Champions League knockout games for the last few years. And defensively, we really trust Mendy. Nacho has had a poor year. So we were worried about the fact that, you know, because Tchouameni has been able to fill in center back amid injuries and has done really well. But Tchouameni couldn't have played at the Etihad because of suspension. So we were really worried about that. But Nacho did really well against Holland and defended really well. So we're okay with it. I think if you had asked this a couple weeks ago, like 3 weeks ago, we would have been pretty worried about this. But because we saw Nacho kind of make a comeback at the Etihad, we're feeling a little bit more comfortable with his presence there. So that's the situation there. Of course, if Nacho starts, that does mean Camavinga will go to the bench, because Tchouameni will play as a defensive midfielder and Camavinga, there's just no more room, because Fede Valverde and Toni Kroos are untouchable right now with the way they're playing. So that means Camavinga will come off the bench if those reports are true. But again, I don't know for sure. I mean, there have been reports that state that. You just never really know still for sure. These predicted lineups and these reports get it wrong all the time. And Carlo may opt to put Tchouameni center back with Camavinga as the DM, like he did in the first leg against City. So I wouldn't put it past him, but possibly because of Nacho's performance at the Etihad, you know, Carlo may lean towards, you know, rolling with that again, because it did work defensively.
Now, coming on to Nacho, how do you feel about him tackling the Bayern attack? Because we saw how he did against City. He was positionally excellent, but he was very good at spotting spaces and closing those spaces to make sure City didn't get as much purchase in the final third. But Bayern Munich is not a team that patiently builds through a block. They're a team that hits at pace. And if there's something that Nacho lacked, even when he was, you know, 27, 28, it's that he lacked pace for the kinds of attacks that he came up against. He wasn't slow. He wasn't horribly slow, but he was definitely not the fastest. And this Bayern Munich team, more than anything, enjoys using their pace to hit defenses when they're sleeping and or when they're out of position.
Nacho is fast, but I do think the way that Bayern will approach us is completely different than the way City did. And like Sid and I were talking about this on a podcast we did Saturday, that, like, for example, comparing Haaland to Kane, Rudiger and Nacho basically over the course of two legs manhandled Haaland, like made him disappear. But Kane is a completely different striker. He is a link-up player. He plays outside the box. He's more creative. He can drop into the left half space. He can combine with the wingers, whether it's Musiala or Guerrero or whoever's going to be on that side. Or he can also do a lot of damage as a target guy. So he can do both, and he's the best striker in the world right now. So it's a different beast. It's a different challenge for Nacho completely. Plus the transition opportunities, like you mentioned, I think more so than City and Leipzig, Bayern are happy to keep this a really tight game, whereas our previous two opponents were not. And of course, that means Real Madrid will naturally probably play a higher line because they'll have more of the ball when the opponent doesn't need to have it as much as our previous opponents. And because of that, we have to be really careful with our the space we leave him behind our defense. There's no question. I don't know if that's particularly like a Nacho concern I have, but more so just that it's a different approach than our previous two opponents. And for that reason, I think Kane is going to be much more challenging than Haaland, for example.
Yeah, but I feel like playing the higher line, yeah, I mean, that's a risk, yeah, of course. But I feel like that's pretty much the only thing you can really do, because if you kind of give Bayern Munich that space in the middle, even if you have a man advantage, if they manage to play vertical enough to get through that, you're kind of just giving up zone 12 to them, and that's not exactly what you want to do. But I feel like, yeah, it is more of a defense thing than a Nacho thing. But I still feel like Nacho in particular sort of seems to be the weak link in that defense, because even if he does have more experience than most of the guys in the team, I just don't feel like he's going to be there sharp enough. He's definitely not in his best years, but I just, something about him feels off. Even in that Sociedad game, or Sociedad game, was it?
Yeah, our last game.
Yeah, the Sociedad game. I don't know, something about him just kind of felt off. I feel like he wasn't at the races.
I mean, he's not had a good year. If you're gonna ask us, yeah, like, who is our weakest link, it's probably him. I mean, although Carvajal is not playing tomorrow, he's suspended, so Lucas Vazquez will play right back. Vazquez obviously, like, famously had, like, a very heroic game at the Etihad with his penalty and other things, but it could also be Lucas Vazquez, because he's got to go up against Mazraoui, Guerrero, Musiala, you know, possibly Davies at some point. So, you know, he's got a tough assignment too. But yeah, if you're going to ask us, like, who the weak link is between, like, Nacho, Rudiger, and Mendy and Tchouameni, it's probably Nacho. No, there's no question about that. But I would, I guess, warn you that I feel like when we're talking about ceiling and floors, Nacho in the Champions League kind of, like, seems like he's up for it at times. Like he was against City last season against Mohamed Salah. He locked him up over two legs against Liverpool. Our ideal situation is, you know, Militao gets to 100% and he's going to start over Nacho or even Alaba, right? But they're both, Militao probably will be a minimal part of these two legs. I guess you're correct on that, but I would also say Nacho might be up for it more than you think.
I'm sure he will be, because again, it's Real Madrid in the UCL. These players know what they're doing. They always seem to surprise.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the thing, like, with this is kind of classic Real Madrid too. Not everyone who will arrive to this game in tip top form or shape, but we're pretty damn close to it. But it does seem like these nights, you know, we can get the best out of a lot of these players. But I think the bigger concern, I don't know if concern is the right word, but just kind of like, again, I'm curious to see how we'll deal with the fact that this is a bit of a different opponent than our previous opponents. And can we just have enough movement between the lines? Can we have enough fluidity on offense? You know, watching that Frankfurt game, I think, and especially that Arsenal game, the way you guys just zipped up all the lines and were able to track runs. And you guys have a lot of good movement between the lines in their build-up phase too. Like, I think, and I noticed that too, like, when you have Kane plus, like, line breakers around him, and obviously Musiala is the primary one, that can definitely give us problems. So I'm really curious to know how this goes. But in a lot of ways, the first leg to me is kind of like, let's see how both these two teams approach it. And I don't think there's going to be a huge scoreline either way. You know, maybe a minimal win for either opponent. And then the second leg is kind of where we see everything happen.
That's not good for us, because it's at the Santiago Bernabeu, and I don't know how I feel about that.
Hey, man, if it makes you feel any better, Tuchel erased a 3-0 lead when he was at Chelsea a couple years ago. Ultimately lost, but, you know, he did erase it at some point. did you have anything else on your mind?
Yeah, actually, this is not exactly related to the matchup itself, but what's going on with the Bernabeu grass? I feel like something's gone wrong there.
So I was having a conversation with this about this with Graham Hunter. I forget which game it was that I was at recently at the Bernabeu. And it was a game where the grass, again, was terrible. it's always bad. And he was saying that he had just chatted with Paul Burgess, who was our, what is even the role? I wanted to say botanist, but I feel like that's inaccurate. But either way, he's in charge of the grass, okay? He's like, it's like his specialty. Like, he's like, this is his PhD, like, his bread and butter, his expertise is how to, for lack of a better word, how to grow grass. The guy is genius at this.
Right.
When the Bernabeu was being renovated, Paul Burgess looked at the new pitch system that kind of rotates, and there's like a basically a greenhouse underground, and it, you know, just this whole state of the art thing. He said that's a bad idea. The grass is going to be bad, basically. And they had disagreements, and he left because he didn't agree with the new system. And he said, your grass is going to suck, basically. And after that, I think he's been vindicated. So I don't know. Maybe they need to bring him back. I don't know what it is. No one really knows, because they're like, they've spent all this money on this infrastructure. It's this brand new stadium, all these renovations, but the grass is just bad. And I don't really know, like, beyond that, I don't know what to tell you, but it's definitely a problem. And it's quite embarrassing that this is the state of the Bernabeu grass right now. It's pretty bad.
You will not believe how I came to the conclusion that the Bernabeu grass is going bad, because I haven't watched a lot of Madrid this season, and I hadn't noticed the grass being that bad. But I kept seeing, you know, Fabrizio Romano every few weeks would post, you know, a new Real Madrid player has an ankle injury, and it would be the same injuries that I've gotten in the last year. And I was like, yo, what's going on? And then I realized I got my ankle injuries, all three of them, at the same pitch, which is a pitch that has a reputation for not having the best grass. And that's sort of how I put two and two together, that Bernabeu grass has gone bad. And then I started watching games, and then I noticed that, yeah, the surface doesn't look that good. It was the strangest connection of thoughts.
Yeah. And to be quite honest, it's kind of hard to see when you're like, because like we usually, we're at every game and you don't really see because we're like high up and you don't know that the grass is bad until like after the game, the opposing coach is like complaining about it in the press conference. It's hard to see, but then like you only see it like when it zooms in, like the camera zooms in, you can see like all these like little scuffs and little holes and these weird patches. I don't know what's going on. Yeah, it's pretty bad. It's embarrassing. It's embarrassing for a club this size to have these problems, no question. It's been changed like five times this season and still nothing. At first, they blamed it on the dust. They said the dust from the renovation is getting into the grass and it's causing problems, but I don't know if they have that excuse anymore.
Yeah, to be fair, the Allianz has had some problems with the grass as well. But yeah, I just feel like there's so many, like, I feel like it's mostly down to the fact that these stadiums are getting new systems implemented that aren't exactly the healthiest for the surface itself.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but, I didn't expect you that to be one of your questions, but...
Yeah, no, I felt like it was relevant since the second leg is coming up soon, and I don't know about either of these playing surfaces. I don't think they're ideal. But I also wanted to ask you about that attack, because the structure of it is almost non-existent, right? It's a very loose, very free moving attack. But it seems like Vinny Jr. and Rodrigo seem to occupy a lot of the same spaces sometimes. Like, even watching, again, I think it was the Sociedad game, both of them kind of sat in the half space on the left a lot. Vinny was more advanced than Rodrigo, granted. But it just felt like they were in the same spaces a lot. I didn't quite know if that's what Real always do, because I haven't watched too much Real this season. I should, though, not going to lie.
Well, this part of the attack is actually in some ways a little bit unpredictable, what Carlo does. He does allow for free roaming movement, and usually the most stationary of the front three is Vinicius. And by stationary, I mean he's the one who hugs the left touchline the most. Rodrigo himself has said this publicly, that his favorite position is down the middle. Like, he likes to go down the middle. And of course, Jude is kind of roaming everywhere too, right? We do not have a pure right winger in the squad. The closest thing we have, I guess, I mean, Brahim can play on either wing. Valverde is more of a right central midfielder, but has played right wing at times. Arda Güler, I suppose, can play that kind of inverted winger role, but he doesn't play much. So we don't really have a pure right winger in that sense. And so a lot of our play is actually, we just overload the left side. So we don't have a right winger. This happened a lot. This is not a new phenomenon with Real Madrid. Like, this goes all the way back to the Cristiano days, where we had, instead of like often Zidane putting like a right winger, because Bale was injured so much and sometimes out of form, we would just put Isco, who is not a winger. So you would have Isco, Cristiano, Benzema, Toni Kroos, Marcelo, all overloading the left side, no right winger. But then Carvajal would make that run on the right, and we would suck the entire defense in, and then Toni Kroos would play the diagonal long ball, and Carvajal's wide open on the right. No one's marking that side. So that's been the kind of a system we've used for a long time. And actually, I don't like, I see a little bit of that kind of play in Bayern too, where they like to overload one side and then ping the long diagonal to free up space on the right. Maybe Kimmich makes the overload. But it is kind of unpredictable in this sense, Ryan, is that like against Manchester City, Carlo's curveball was that he put Rodrigo on the left wing and then Vinicius a little bit more central, right?
Yeah.
And you still had it kind of had them both on the left, but they kind of swapped positions. And then the next game, I forget which game it was, we had something more Clasico. Symmetrical. What's that?
I think it was El Clasico next,
no? Correct. Yes, El Clasico. Well, no, I'm talking about the first leg. So first leg, we had, I think Mallorca in between or someone. One of those games, we actually flipped it and Rodrigo played as a pure right winger and we were completely symmetrical. What will Carlo do this time? I'm not sure. But there is a little bit of variability to the attack, but you're right. Generally speaking, it's more overloaded to the left side. We like to double up on that wing and Vinicius and Rodrigo like to play off each other. And then usually we try to get Fede or Carvajal running on the opposite side.
And that's interesting to me because I feel like that flank is where a lot of this game is going to end up coming down to, because one of Vinny Rodrigo or both of Vinny Rodrigo are going to be patrolling areas near Joshua Kimmich a lot of the time. But when we attack, a lot of the time, again, what we tend to do is we get the ball, as you said, to one side, and that's usually the left side, and then we switch it to the right. And what's happened a lot is Kimmich and the right winger have tended to overload the left back. And we're unsure of who's going to play left back in this Real Madrid game, but regardless of who it is, not sure they can handle a 2v1 involving, you know, Kimmich and Zane or Kimmich and Gnabry or Kimmich and Musiala or Kimmich and Muller, whoever it is. So that could get very interesting, especially since, you know, Modric also tends to be a little bit more in the right half space, but, you know, he tends to switch roles a lot. I think last time I watched him, he was tending more towards the right. But that sort of... The fact that both structures are somewhat asymmetrical and both of their asymmetries favor the same side, that for me creates a very interesting game. I feel like that's where a lot of chances could come from. It's just the fact that both teams tend to, you know, funnel down the same side.
How much... What is the primary difference between Mazraoui and Davies?
I feel like you can't really call it a primary difference because they are fundamentally different players. Mm. Davies is a physical specimen who is technically just a blunt instrument. And in terms of decision-making, he tends to make the right decisions, but often too late. Mazraoui, on the other hand, he's not very strong. He's not very fast. He's not very tall. But he makes all the correct decisions and he has this perfect technical execution. He's one of my favorite players to watch because he just never makes a mistake on the ball. He's always calm. He always releases on time. They're very different players to me.
Did you have any other questions? We did have one super chat question towards you. I wanted to make sure we hit all your questions first. Yeah? Want to move to the question?
Okay. Yeah.
First of all, shout out to our new members, Shivam Tiwari and Alex Steiberg. Welcome to the YouTube membership family. Pranav Jadhav says, I read somewhere that Dyer and De Ligt are poor 1v1. Is this true?
I would say it's true for Eric Dyer. I feel like De Ligt is not somebody we should be talking about this game because he is unfit for it, but I have to say that De Ligt is pretty underrated in 1v1 situations, especially when the attacker is not directly on the ball and is running onto a loose ball. He tends to be very strong in those situations. I do feel like maybe that reputation is a bit tainted by a very infamous incident in the Super Cup earlier this season where he got nutmegged by Dani Olmo. But other than that, he very rarely makes these mistakes. And it shows because almost every Champions League campaign that he's had where he reaches the knockouts, he's had at least one special moment that people look back on and they're like, oh my God, you know, this was a special moment from a defender. You know, you have the tackle that he made on Angel Correa when he was at Juventus. You had that entire Ajax run. And even in Bayern last season, he had that amazing goal line clearance and general performance against Paris Saint-Germain. I think he made two goal line clearances across both legs. So I feel like the notion that De Ligt is poor in a 1v1 is not true, but I can definitely see that being true for Dyer. I think Dyer relies more on just his positioning than his ability to win the ball back directly.
If everyone is healthy, is your best center back partnership De Ligt and Kim?
Yes. For me, yes. But Tuchel tends to play a different kind of tactical setup where he likes to have one center back who is more adventurous on the ball, which is why he's always had one of Upamecano or Eric Dier playing, regardless of whether Kim and De Ligt are fit. It's led to a lot of complaints in the fan base, but I can see why he's doing it. I don't agree with it, but I can see why.
Upamecano is, what's his health status?
As far as I know, he is fit to play, but he's probably not going to play. He just hasn't played the last few weeks. He hasn't been very sharp. He just seems to be very mistake prone towards the end of the season, but this season just felt different. He never really felt like he was on, the top of his game ever. Whereas last season, he felt at times like he was unbeatable, and then those Man City games came, and of course, his reputation was maybe forever tarnished.
Well, this is what I was going to ask. If, like, deep down as a fan, do you feel like it's addition by subtraction for him not being on the field for these big moments? Because he's become... He has kind of accumulated a few memes for himself in these with the mistakes in the Champions League over the years.
Yeah, I have to say, I've been one of the biggest defenders of Upamecano in general, mostly because under Nagelsmann, he just seemed like a special player. But it seems like when it comes down to important moments towards the end of the season, he just doesn't seem to crack it mentally, which is very weird because during the first 6 months of the season, almost every season that he's played, even in, important 1v1 moments or moments where Bayern have really needed something special, he's been the guy to bring those out. So I don't really know what changes when it goes from that to the spring season, but something seems to change in him. So yeah, I am very happy that he's not playing. That sounds a little mean, but...
No, I get it. Yeah, I get it. One more super chat. Rajan Makwana says, which team will be most hindered by the injuries?
What do you think?
I mean, it's probably Bayern, unless all this is mind games and nobody's injured. But we do know for sure Coman is injured. That's at least one who's out for sure. Someone else was out for sure. Who was it?
Sasha Bowie is also out for sure, but he wasn't going to play this game anyway. De Ligt is also out for sure, and that's painful because he was probably going to be our most important defender this game. So I feel like it is on us, but it's not like you guys aren't missing no one, right? Dani Carvalho has had an amazing season this season, so he's a big miss. David Alaba, maybe not as good as Carvajal, but he's an important player, and you guys aren't missing a centre-back right now. And, I mean, Thibaut Courtois is Thibaut Courtois.
Yeah, technically the only player who's actually injured for us is Alaba because Courtois is technically back. He's not going to play, but he's back. Yeah. He's training. He's in the squad. And Militao played against Real Sociedad in a few games before that. So he's technically back too, just not 100% match fit. So it's got to be Bayern. It's got to be. The answer to this question is absolutely Bayern. It has to be. Do you guys have any... I guess not. I forgot the yellow card thing gets wiped away. So you guys have neither of us have yellow card concerns. Okay. Did we miss anything?
I don't think we did. I think we've pretty much addressed everything. Phase one, phase two. Yeah, I feel like we've addressed pretty much the entire field, honestly. I feel like it was a pretty comprehensive thing.
Do you have thoughts on the Uli Hoeneß and Thomas Tuchel, whatever's happening back and forth?
I have my reservations about both figures, particularly because I honestly feel like I might be more of... this is going to come back to haunt me if I say this publicly, but I've sort of fallen basically in love with the way that Julian Nagelsmann plays football. And when he came to Bayern Munich, it was a dream come true for me. And when he got fired, I sort of dissociated with the club slightly. So the fact that Tuchel came in after, I didn't really hold any resentment for Tuchel, but I feel like subconsciously I've always viewed him with a critical lens, even if I wanted to feel like I was unbiased. And a big part of the reason Nagelsmann didn't come back is that the figureheads of the club couldn't agree on Nagelsmann. I think Uli was in support of Nagelsmann, but Karl-Heinz Rummenigge was not. And the fact that these two still have power at the club, it irks me. So I have my reservations about both figures. I don't support either of them. But I do agree that what Hernes said is unacceptable when we're about to enter a Champions League semi-final, literally, you know, a day from now.
Yeah, I think that's the biggest issue about whether or not his comments are true or not is more like, why do this now? Like,
yeah,
should this just not be aired publicly, like, for the good of the club?
Yeah.
Then the answer is probably like, yeah, just keep it to yourself. But hey, as a Real Madrid fan, not complaining. It's nice to see that drama unfold on the opposite side. Look, man, we got a big game tomorrow. I was mentioning this to on the Saturday podcast with Sid that, like, it almost feels like we haven't quite processed the City win yet in some ways, because, like, we were on such a high and it was so difficult for us to win at the Etihad, and we did it. But it almost felt like nothing will be as difficult as that. And for that reason, like, you know, just kind of like, oh, this is going to be difficult. So, like, I know, like, there are definitely fans who are overlooking Bayern. And I don't think, like, history has proven that that just cannot be the case. You cannot overlook. It's pretty much dead even historically between us. Like, I think it's like one of us has one more win, but it's everything is dead even. Wins for either side, and then the rest are draws. And it's just such a tight affair, no matter what the form is between either of us. And I remember, like, you know, I grew up watching Real Madrid. My first season watching them was 97, 98. And I remember even in the 99-2000 season, Bayern was so much better than us on paper. In the group stages, they destroyed us 4-2 at the Bernabeu and then 4-1 in Munich. And then we weren't expected to, but we knocked them out somehow in the semifinals. And so, like, even when one of us is, like, much inferior to the other, which is not the case that many times, but it's still tight. It's still tight. And I think it's not going to be any different tomorrow and in the second leg. So, Ryan, I appreciate your time. Where can people find your work? You have your Twitter handle on your user there. Let me just bring that.
Yeah, I do.
There it is. At BFW Seiler. And
thank you for having me, please.
What's that?
Thank you for having me. This is really fun, actually.
Yeah, no, this is great. We should definitely see if we can do this before the second leg as well. Hopefully, it will still be on good terms after the first leg. And we can do something before the second leg as well. Also, everyone, please go check out Bavarian Football Works. They are part of the SB Nation / Vox Media Network umbrella, whatever you want to call it. And they are the managing manager of Bayern Munich. So you can go on their website. They're very active. Constant news, constant analysis. You guys do podcasts at least, like, it seems daily, yep. Right?
Thrice a week.
Okay. So you guys are very active on the podcast. You're very active on the website, written form, audio, everything. Please go to BavarianFootballWorks.com. No doubt they will have pregame analysis and also postgame analysis after the game. Just make sure if you're going to go there and become a member and subscribe and comment, please be respectful. And that's all I got to say. Other than that, please go to the website. Ryan, thank you so much, my friend. It was great chatting with you, and we'll talk soon. Peace out.
Thanks for having me. See you.
Sports Social Podcast Network.